welcome all to the MDS podcast, the podcast channel of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. This is Michele Matarazzo, the editor-in-chief of the podcast. In this special issue, we are going to tackle a very hot topic, which is the role of synuclein-based therapies in Parkinson's disease. To discuss about this, we have the pleasure to have two guests, both first authors of the two clinical trials of anti-synuclein antibodies in PD that have been published back-to-back in the New England Journal of Medicine a few months ago. Professor Anthony Lang from the University of Toronto, and one of the people who have contributed the most to the field of movement disorder in general, and also the past president of the Movement Disorder Society, as well as the past editor of the Movement Disorder Journal, is the first author of the paper Trial of Sympanemab in Early Parkinson's Disease. Welcome to the podcast. It is a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Michele.
Our other guest is Dr. Gennaro Pagano, currently expert medical director and group leader at Roche and author of the article Trial of Prasinezumab in Early Stage Parkinson's Disease. Welcome to the MDS podcast, Gennaro.
Thank you, Michele.
Okay, so this is a very relevant and a hot topic in our field. So let's try to explain to our listeners the whole story behind alpha-synuclein in PD that led to these two clinical trials, what happened with them, and also what lies ahead of us. It's not going to be easy, but let's start with the basics. Tony, what is the link between Parkinson's disease and alpha-synuclein? What do we know of this controversial relationship?
Well, I think most of your listeners probably know that alpha-synuclein is thought to be a hallmark of the pathology of Parkinson's disease because it is a consistent component of the Lewy pathology, the Lewy bodies and the Lewy neurites. This was found when the first gene causative of Parkinson's disease was discovered, alpha-synuclein, the A53T mutation. And shortly after that discovery, Maria Spilantini and her colleagues demonstrated that Lewy bodies contained alpha-synuclein. And we now recognize, in fact, that that presence of alpha-synuclein is even becoming a diagnostic test for Parkinson's disease with the misfolded protein used in seeding amplification assays in cerebrospinal fluid and skin, for example, in a very high proportion of patients that we think have Parkinson's disease. So there's a major link between synuclein and Parkinson's. Based on that, then, there is a lot of belief that the misfolded protein has acquired toxic effects and has the ability to generate the neurodegenerative disease or drive the neurodegenerative disease. In addition, there are many biological pathways that are dysfunctional in Parkinson's disease that may allow synuclein to accumulate. So we have a bidirectional process, synuclein driving abnormal pathways and abnormal pathways allowing synuclein to accumulate. And so it's believed that synuclein is a major player one way or another in the neurodegenerative process. And so it's logical that anti-synuclein therapies were explored or should be explored.
Well, thank you. So I think you already explained most of this, but focusing on the pathogenicity of synuclein in PD, Gennaro, apart from knowing that there is this very relevant link between the disease and the presence of misfolded alpha-synuclein, as was pointed out by Tony, do we have any preclinical evidence that it actually might be pathogenic, that it leads to neurodegeneration?
Yes, we do. Although all the preclinical study, animal study, cannot be fully translated in the human Parkinson's disease, they are models, we have both in vitro and in vivo evidence that an increase in the wild-type form of synuclein or using mutated form of synuclein induces a series of toxic reaction in the brain of this. So we have evidence that the aggregated form of synuclein seems to be seeding, as we also have evidence in humans in the CSF, but in the animal studies, they induce wild-type synuclein to begin more aggregated form, and there is some sort of propagation. So neurons that are healthy, they don't have seeding, aggregated synuclein get affected by this seeding over time. Why this is toxic, we don't exactly know, but we know that this in the extracellular space activate in an abnormal fashion astroglia and macroglia that have an important role in maintaining the synaptic plasticity. So if there is an excess of aggregated alpha-synuclein, it's likely to affect how the synapse integrity is maintained over time. Another big evidence in the preclinical studies is that if you use monoclonal antibody or therapies that target this aggregated form, it's possible to revert the phenotype induced by the pathogenic aggregation of alpha-synuclein. Again, preclinical evidence, no way to measure this in human yet, although seems to be strong enough to develop drugs on this direction.
So from the preclinical point of view, there is quite a good amount of evidence that it might be pathogenic, and that's basically the reason why we are going in this direction in the field, right? Is there anything else you want to add on this, Tony?
Other thing that has driven it a little bit is the finding of Lewy pathology in transplanted neurons, fetal neurons, in patients who underwent fetal transplantation. So 5 or more years, and I'll come back to that later, after patients underwent fetal nigral transplantation, a couple of different groups discovered the presence of Lewy pathology, Lewy bodies in the transplanted neurons. So the belief was that the host with Parkinson's disease induced the pathology in the transplanted neurons. And so this drove the concept of cell-to-cell transmission of the toxic synuclein and raised the idea of Parkinson's being a prion-like disorder. And this is very hot in all neurodegenerative diseases now, the belief that these misfolded proteins do indeed spread from cell to cell, and then by a permissive templating prion-like process, they are capable of inducing changes in the neurons taking up the abnormal synuclein and inducing misfolding in the wild type of synuclein in the neurons that are taking it up. So I think all of that then drives the idea of anti-synuclein therapies.
That's a very good point. That was certainly a breakthrough in our understanding of PD back then. Now let's focus on the trials. Maybe we can start with the Sympanemab, the so-called SPARK clinical trial. It was stopped due to non-efficacy in an interim analysis. Tony, what happened in this trial? Could you please summarize the results and the relevant findings of the trial?
Well, both trials were very similar. I think they were both extremely well designed. They were logical. They took early untreated patients with Parkinson's disease and randomized them to the two treatments, varying in the number of arms with different doses, but they both had the same primary outcome variable. And unfortunately, the Sympanemab trial demonstrated that both the primary outcome variable, the MDS-UPDRS score, the combination of 1, 2, 3, was no different between the placebo and the active arm. In contrast to the prasinezumab study, the secondary outcomes were also non-significant. So we looked at a variety of them, the subscores of all of the Parkinson rating scales, and unfortunately, none of those showed any signal of positive benefit.
Good. Now, the other trial called the Pasadena, also a phase 2 randomized placebo-controlled trial, but this time with prasinezumab. What was the primary endpoint here, and what were the main conclusions, the main results of the study, Gennaro?
Miguel, the primary endpoint was the same, that is the sum of part 1, part 2, and part 3. And prasinezumab did not meet its primary endpoint in the study, but there was no difference on part 1 and 2, but there was difference in part 3. And the main reason we explain this difference is because for a study that tests the effect on progression, you need the scale to progress over time. Unfortunately, in this population over 1 year duration, is an early stage Parkinson's disease, there was very little progression in MDS-UPDRS part 1 and MDS-UPDRS part 2, where there was quite significant progression in MDS-UPDRS part 3. This could be one of the reasons that contributed to this signal, that we can call it signal because primary was not met. At the same time, we also analyzed deeply the Pasadena results to assess the unique feature of this trial. One thing that is unique in Pasadena compared to other trials in the same field is that we included not only treatment naive, but also people treated with MAO-B inhibitors. And in this population, the change over 1 year was larger than the change in the treatment naive. This was true for the placebo group, right? We are talking about approximately 7-point change versus 4 points in the treatment naive. But when you evaluate the treatment effect in the MAO-B subgroups, that is unique of Pasadena, there was a much larger effect, reaching a 40% separation of the curve. These are the reasons why we think prasinezumab might have some unique features, including the fact that it binds on the C-terminal component of the protein and binds to all synuclein species, right? Most of these antibodies, we think that aggregated synuclein is the most pathogenic one. But prasinezumab bind mostly aggregated, but also bind to monomeric and whatever is in the middle. In absence of knowledge what is the most pathogenic species, we might hypothesize that prasinezumab might bind a species that is unknown. And this could be driven due to these results.
Great. So they were very, very similar, the two trials. You can even think that the same people designed the two trials, that how similar they were. But there were this signal in the Pasadena. Do you think that there are other major differences between the two molecules or the two drugs? Tony, maybe they're relevant. What do you think?
Yes, well, I think Gennaro touched on the main issues. So the two agents, the two antibodies bind different areas in the synuclein protein. The Biogen molecule binds the N-terminus and the Roche, the C-terminus. As Gennaro indicated, the Roche antibody binds the monomeric as well as the aggregated protein, whereas the Biogen molecule binds largely the aggregated protein. So if you stain Parkinson's brain, you find only the abnormal protein on immunohistochemistry as opposed to control brain showing some staining with the Roche compound. So there are differences, and whether those account for the clinical differences, we don't know. The proof will be in the subsequent study that Roche is conducting. I guess I would still point out the effects are small. And so my belief is we're going to need more than this approach. And we can talk about why this approach either failed or showed only minimal effects as we continue our discussion.
Yeah, actually, talking about that, one thing that worried me a little bit, if I remember well, the previous studies of both antibodies, when studied in the CSF, only less than 1% of the drug passed the blood CSF barrier. Is that not a low number, or are you not worried of target engagement with a low number, Gennaro?
Prasinezumab was tested in phase 1b, as you said, both in healthy and then in Parkinson patient, and the average of the dose that were used then in phase 2, the 1,500 milligram and 4,500 milligram, was about 0.3%. So the 0.3% of that will be in the CSF. Now, what is the minimum amount of prasinezumab or monoclonal antibody needed to bind enough aggregated alpha-synuclein is unknown. Until we will have a PET tracer or a central target engagement marker, will be difficult. But in absolute, 0.3% over 4,500 milligram might be still good, right? A drug that works at 10 milligram, at 5 milligram, at 0.5 milligram, right? And the amount of synuclein, if you compare to other proteinopathy like amyloid, seems to be much less if you look at postmortem. So it's not excluded that the amount of prasinezumab used with this brain penetration might be enough to bind all the synuclein that is there, although only with biomarker we'll be able to disentangle that.
Yeah, and another question that I had, maybe Tony, you can answer to that, is we've been talking a lot about alpha-synuclein and how it links with Parkinson's disease. And right now we've been discussing these two trials, which are antibodies. But antibodies is just one of the possible strategies to modulate alpha-synuclein. Would you think that antibodies have advantages or disadvantages as compared with other possible mechanisms, let's say antisense oligonucleotides or other small molecules targeting aggregation, for example? I know these other drugs are becoming available to clinical trials right now, actually.
Well, I think we generally believe that the antibodies target the extracellular synuclein. So it's the cell-to-cell transmission component that we believe it would be largely impacted by the antibodies. And we really just don't know, as I think Gennaro was pointing out, the amount of extracellular synuclein that exists. We don't know how rapid this process is. So for example, I'll come back to a point that I made earlier. Remembering the transplanted cases, the aggregated synuclein at least wasn't seen until after 5 or 6 years post-transplant. So the small number of patients who were studied having died before the 5-year mark did not show pathologic phosphorylated synuclein, for example. And so it's not clear whether we're targeting a process that is extremely slow. Remember, Parkinson's is a slowly progressive disease. And again, whether we're expecting too much out of a trial that's only lasting 12 to 18 months in a process that's very, very slow and is taking far longer to occur, we don't know. Another point that I've made in discussing these trials is that we also don't know whether in the early stages of the disease, we're targeting the right thing. So the progression of motor Parkinson's in early disease is largely representative or indicative of ongoing dopamine reduction. So the features that we're examining in our patients are largely dopaminergic. And we know that by the simple fact that you start levodopa and a lot of these things get better, right? And so we don't know whether the progression at the stages that we're studying these patients in these trials relates to ongoing cell-to-cell transmission of synuclein. Or let's look at another way. Maybe the nigra has been hit by pathogenic synuclein already, and now we're dealing with other processes like free radicals and mitochondrial dysfunction and all the things that have been triggered by the involvement of the nigral neurons. And now they're trying to compensate, they're turning over dopamine more, and you're getting a lot of changes that result in progressive dopaminergic dysfunction that have nothing to do with progressive synuclein changes. Maybe we're not dealing with early disease and progression that we're following in the early stages might not be due to ongoing synuclein extracellular dysfunction. It's also possible it's intracellular changes, but maybe not the changes that we're going to be targeting with a monoclonal antibody. So to just finish, yes, I think there probably is going to be a need to move to other anti-synuclein therapies. You mentioned the reduction of synuclein formation, transcription of synuclein with various techniques. And I think that there are anti-aggregant therapies that are being studied, a variety of other techniques that I think we're going to potentially see also possibly in addition to, in combination with monoclonal antibodies. So this is why I hope the companies that have developed a monoclonal antibody that fails don't throw it away. Maybe it will be used in combination with another anti-synuclein therapy.
I think the main two points you were making, and I think those are two very important messages. One is possibly the driving causes of neuropathology are not the compensatory mechanisms, and these two things together are what are provoking the symptoms in PD, and they may actually have different timelines in the brain. And so it's impossible to say whether if we stop the cell-to-cell transmission, which would be maybe the mechanism that is driving the neuropathology, will have an effect so early. And then the other thing is that we possibly need much longer clinical trials. I think that was one of the important points. And actually, I know you have written a viewpoint on this, and those were some of the points you pointed out. And Gennaro, you wanted to say something on this?
If I can build on what Tony was just discussing, I think there are two main processes that we can target with alpha-synuclein. One is targeting the pathogenic forms, if we find which one, but aggregated is the current one that we believe, maybe a different one, like cross-translational modification. And the other one is going after reducing the wild-type production of synuclein. And there are very good strategies out there. And the combination of synuclein aggregates, right, and the modification is not a single process, what Tony was pointing. I totally agree that it's a dynamic, it's very dynamic. There's not just intracellular, it goes extracellular, it goes to other neurons, but it's not just the neurons, it's also the microglia, the astroglia, the inflammation, what we call it, right? It can play maybe at that stage of disease on motor progression a much bigger role, while during the onset of the disease, you need a mutation or a propensity to aggregates, right? And then later you need something else. So the targets that we need to go after maybe are many and different at different stage of the disease.
Great. You both made a good argument for the complexity of all of this, and we should not just draw firm conclusions with one study or with just one clinical trial. And actually, as we approach the end of this interview, I would like to leave the listeners with an idea of what will happen in the future. Well, in the current world of radicalized opinions, and it's very easy to find social media extremists of pro-synuclein and anti-synuclein theories. Sometimes it is actually difficult to find the balance. Where do you stand in this controversy, Tony? How do we navigate in this ocean of controversial information? It's complicated sometimes, right?
Very complicated. And as you've pointed out, there are vocal proponents for all sides. We've not gotten into a very long discussion of the PNIC hypothesis that maybe we shouldn't get into. I think that most people feel that you don't want to lower levels to the point that the synapse can't function, but the evidence for a proteopenic component is rather slim, whereas the evidence for synuclein contributing to the disease, I think, is massive and can't be denied, not the least of which would be the presence of the pathogenic synuclein on the seeding amplification assays in patients at the very earliest stages of the illness, for example, when they have rapid eye movement behavior disorder alone. I just cannot imagine that you can combine that with a concept that a reduction in the protein levels is actually the cause of the disease. But I think we still need to avoid reducing levels to the point that the synapse may have difficulty functioning. But I think good science prevails. Open discussion prevails. Hopefully, open discussion after a good glass of wine also helps a little bit. And so I think as long as everybody is willing to listen and not block out opinions, I think that's the most important.
Great. You touched upon this proteinopathy versus proteinopenia thing. And as you were saying, well, hopefully more basic science will also help us understand how much each of these things might contribute with what is happening. In general, I see you want to add something.
I don't see the two here in a way in totally contrast. Let me clarify my point. You have synuclein, right, in the brain that is doing something. We don't really know exactly what. It's linked to synaptic transmission. So if you don't have synuclein, one type normal synuclein, maybe it's a problem, right? So it would not reduce that. But if you have synuclein that aggregate into pathogenic form and the seeding take the normal synuclein away, it's basically inducing a proteopenia on the neurons that need synuclein for their work. So in a way, targeting aggregates, it could eventually restore the normal. So it's kind of boosting the normal. And you could measure that in the CSF, right? Unfortunately, the biomarker we don't have yet is strong that can tell us properly because it antibody might interfere with the assay itself. But in Parkinson, you see a reduction in total synuclein in the CSF rather than an increase, right? Well, if you look at genetic carriers of Parkinson mutations, the duplication and triplication, if you look at the total synuclein in the CSF, there is actually an increase, right? So there are some human evidence that you could have reduction of the wild-type function in synuclein, but the hypothesis behind developing the monoclonal antibody targeting the aggregated form is that when you target the aggregates, you remove the bulk that is sinking all the positive monomeric that is doing a good effect. Again, this is a theory. Maybe it doesn't work this way, but in a way, for me, the two theories are not contradicting itself.
And I think it is good, as what you were both mentioning, to leave the conversation open and leave the science open so that we can advance with data and we can advance better, obviously. And as you were mentioning before, Tony, with a glass of wine, maybe even better. But definitely we can advance to something that will change the quality of life and the life of people suffering with Parkinson's disease. Now, we have touched upon most of the points that I wanted to discuss with you. What do you think is the future of the clinical trials in PD? What should we look forward to in the next few years? Tony, maybe if you want to start.
Well, I think that we need disease state biomarkers sorely, because as long as we have trials that are profoundly hampered by the introduction of symptomatic therapy in levodopa, we will never be able to conduct the trials over the time period that really will provide us an understanding of what's happening in the disease. And so I think we really sorely need some way of monitoring the underlying severity of the disease in a reliable fashion, and not just in dopaminergic neurons, but in pathology well beyond the dopamine system. I think that we also need to recognize the tremendous heterogeneity of the disease. And one of the problems that a number of us have been arguing about for a long time is that when we take an early untreated group of Parkinson's disease and put them in a clinical trial, we basically assume that they've got the same disorder and they're a homogeneous group of people that are going to respond in an identical fashion. And we know that's not the case. And so what we need to do is separate out subgroups of patients and maybe highlight those patients that are more likely to respond to a treatment that has a very specific mechanism of action. Some of us are also working very hard on redefining Parkinson's in a biological sense. And a group of us have just proposed or are putting together a novel biological definition of Parkinson's disease. And I think the time has come that we can do that. And so I think that's going to change the future research very much as well.
That sounds extremely interesting. Now I want to learn more about this. Well, let's talk about this later, maybe off microphone. Gennaro, you want to add something else to the future of clinical trials in PD and specifically the ones that are targeting alpha-synuclein?
I totally agree with Tony. Right patient, right targets, right drugs, and right endpoint. Right patient means moving away from clinical to biological definition of disease. Rather than going in Parkinson, you should go in Parkinson with synuclein, with inflammation, with whatever is your target of the drugs, because the drug do not work in disease, they act on biology. So you go to identify the right patient using maybe diagnostic and usually also go into selection of the right patient, right? Precision medicine, what we call. Right drugs that target at that stage, because at different stage of the disease, you might have different targets, so you need different drugs and potentially combination, because one drug might act on a mechanism that induces another mechanism as a compensatory that keep damaging the neurons and the synapses. And then most importantly, Michele, to increase the probability of success, we should be able to change how we assess the progression, moving away from in clinic, sporadic measure of the progression with the scales, towards an ecological, continuous, maybe a home measure, maybe in a digital way or virtual way with phone and the device that can give us an objective measure of what is happening with these drugs.
Can I make one final point that I agree entirely with Gennaro said? I always add when I give a talk about this kind of thing, write drugs, the plural. And I think we really will need combination therapies the way cancer has used for a long time.
Yeah, that is also a very good point. And a lot of research right now is going that direction, even though I don't think we have any clinical trials that have tried to do a disease-modifying therapy or to study disease-modifying therapy in PD with a combination of drugs.
Remarkably, the first disease-modifying trial did just that. DataTop was a 2x2 factorial design of a monoamine oxidase B inhibitor and vitamin E. And it's the only trial, to my knowledge, that has done that. We need to go back to that, but there are a lot of challenges in study design, combining therapies that aren't approved, et cetera. But our field needs to start dealing with that and come to some grips of how to proceed.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you both very much for your time. It has been a pleasure to share some times and some thoughts with you on the MDS podcast and on this very relevant topic. We have had with us Anthony Lang and Gennaro Pagano, and we have discussed the clinical trials with sinpanemab and prasinezumab in early PD, published both in the New England Journal of Medicine. Please make sure to download and read the articles, and thank you all for listening.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.